Thanks again for letting me interview you. It'll be very helpful for the documentary. I
Is that
changed.
a film, or what do you mean when you say documentary?
It's just going to be a 10-minute like film that I'm making for a project that we're doing at school.
Oh, so it is a film.
Yes, it is.
Oh, but the whole thing is just going to be 10 minutes?
Yeah.
Takes me that long to say hello. Go ahead. I'm just joking.
I changed the questions a little bit, but not by that much.
All right. I'll do the
So,
best I can.
the first question is, when you were working at the EEOC, you said that you noticed that they weren't focusing on women's rights. Can you tell me a little more about that?
Yes, I can. Let me think back. Well, let me give you some background to begin with, which partially explains why they weren't focusing on women's rights. When they would, the statute involved here is called Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. And it was passed in 1964, and it became effective on July 2nd, 1965. And the reason that this act was passed was as a result of the civil rights movement for blacks. And there had been no similar movement for women before the passage of this act. The whole reason for the passage of the act was a civil rights movement and to give blacks some rights. Towards the latter part of the debate on the bill, Congressman Howard Smith introduced let me go back, and the act prohibited discrimination based, at that time, the bill prohibited discrimination in employment based on race, color, religion, and national origin. And then, towards the latter part of the debate, Congressman Howard Smith, who was a segregationist and who opposed civil rights, got up and introduced an amendment that sex discrimination in employment should also be prohibited under this act. And his motives are unclear. He was a segregationist. He was opposed to the whole act and voted against it when the time to vote came up. But he also had a relationship with Alice Paul, the founder of the National Woman's Party, and they didn't want blacks gaining rights over white women. So whether he made that amendment because he wanted to forestall passage of the act or kill the act, or whether he really wanted women to be protected, I don't think anybody really knows. But after he proposed that amendment to include sex, there wasn't a great deal of debate about it, but I guess nobody was going to get up and say he opposed it. So the act was passed with a prohibition of sex discrimination in employment in it, but there wasn't a lot of debate on it, the country wasn't ready for it, and all of a sudden we had this new prohibition. So most of the people, I'm afraid I'm going to take up the whole 10 minutes with your first question. What do you want to do about that? Do you want me to continue?
Yes, you can continue.
In the early days at the EEOC, which opened its doors on July 2nd, 1965, as I said, there were about 100 people at headquarters, and most of them, or all of them, had come there to fight discrimination against blacks. And all of a sudden, they had this additional discrimination against women. So there were several reasons why they didn't pay much attention to that. One was that that's not why they had come to the EEOC. They'd come there to fight for black rights. So they didn't want the time and the money of the EEOC to be taken for women's rights when that wasn't the purpose of the act initially. The other reason was that the prohibition against sex discrimination presented a whole flock of legal questions that nobody knew the answer to at that time. discrimination against blacks was, not to be funny, was an issue of black or white. It was very easy to decide whether somebody was being discriminated against because of their race. But it was not so easy to decide what to do about pregnant women on the job, pension plans, maternity leave, a whole bunch of things that nobody knew what to do about, how to interpret it. And also, there hadn't been a women's movement before that was put into the act, so that the people at the OC would know what it was women wanted and how they wanted this act to be interpreted. And in some cases, women were split. So because of all those reasons, for the first, I think it was really the first year and a half, the commission didn't really do much about women's rights.
So this made you very frustrated, right?
I couldn't hear you.
This made you very frustrated, correct?
That is correct.
And how did you meet Betty Friedan?
Well, Betty Friedan, as you may know, published a groundbreaking book in 1963 called The Feminine Mystique. She thought in 1965-66 that she was going to write a second book about all the progress that women had made since the publication in 1963 of The Feminine Mystique. So she came to the Office of the General Counsel at the EEOC to interview the General Counsel and the Deputy General Counsel about all the progress women had made that she thought, all the progress women had made since the publication of her book. And I was at that time, the General Counsel's office consisted of four people. The General Counsel, the Deputy General Counsel, me, and a junior attorney. So Betty Friedan saw me there, and I was a woman, of course, so she came over to me and she said, what's really going on here? What's happening? What's going on? That's how I met her.
And when did you ask her to make an organization for women, and how did that happen?
Well, so I told you that she came over to me the first time she came to the General Counsel's office, and I can never remember whether this was towards the end of 65 or in the beginning of 66. But anyway, she asked me those questions, and I said to myself, and you would have read this in the chapter that I sent you called Sex Maniac. I don't know if you had a chance to read it. But anyway, I said to myself, if I tell this woman what's really going on here with regard to women, I'm going to lose my job. So I said to her, nothing is going on here, everything's fine. And then she came back a couple of weeks later and again came into the office, and she came at a time that I've been particularly frustrated with the fact that the commission wasn't doing anything about women's rights. And I'd had it up to, I would take my finger across my neck if you were here. I'd had it up to there. And I invited her into the privacy of my office. And I had tears in my eyes. And I told her what was going on. And I said, what this country needs is an organization to fight for women like the NAACP fights for, and in those days I probably would have said Negroes or colored people.
So what was Betty like as a person?
Well, I was afraid you would ask me that question, and I don't know that I want to go public with it. Let me say that she was the foremost person in the 60s and maybe later with regard to women's rights, and she was the person in the country people thought of in connection with women's rights, and she was really the standard bearer. As a person, she had some flaws.
So, how was NOW founded?
Well, I told you that I suggested to her that we need an organization. Oh, I know what happened. In June of 1966, there was the third annual meeting of the commissions on the status of women about every state had a commission on the status of women. And there was the conference of those commissions in Washington, D.C. It was a third annual conference. So the women present wanted to pass a resolution demanding that the EOC enforce Title VII's provisions for women, and also demanding that the president reappoint one of the commissioners, Richard Graham, who, while a man, was a feminist. And they thought that he wasn't going to be reappointed because he was a feminist. He actually told me later when I asked him that that wasn't true. But the women at this meeting thought that it was true. So they wanted to pass those two resolutions. That meeting was held under the auspices of the U.S. Department of Labor. And there is a provision or a law that one federal agency can't tell another federal agency what to do. So the Labor Department officials told the women at that meeting that they could not pass those two resolutions because of this provision that I told you, that one federal agency, in this case the Labor Department, can't tell another one, the EOC, what it should do. I wasn't at that meeting. It was in June of 1966, but what I was told was that the women got upset when they were told that they didn't have the right to pass resolutions. It may be that they didn't understand what I just told you about one federal agency can't tell another one what to do. But in any event, they were upset. I think they gathered that night in Betty Friedan's hotel room and talked about it. I wasn't there, but I think that's what happened. The next day at lunch, Betty Friedan took out a napkin and wrote, I have the language in my Sex Maniac piece, but something to the effect that we are creating an organization to fight for women now, N-O-W. And there were 28 women who were with her, and each of them put in $5. That was the first meeting at which NOW was founded. Then there was a second meeting on Halloween weekend in 1966. Both of these meetings were in Washington, D.C. The second one I attended, and at that meeting, another 21 people, men and women, joined as founders, so there were a total of 49 founders. And at that meeting, we also adopted a statement of purpose and, I think, temporary bylaws. And NOW was founded.
So how did NOW grow so quickly?
I don't really know the answer to that. My guess is, this is the first part of the guess, that in 1966, women had the second-class status in this country every which way. The only right they had was to vote. They also had the right to own property. In the past, they didn't have that right. In the past, a husband and wife were considered one person, and the husband was that person. But women didn't have a great many rights. They certainly didn't have the right to be free of employment discrimination. They weren't admitted equally to colleges and universities, especially graduate programs. They were basically, when they tried to get into a graduate program, they were told you ought to be ashamed of yourself. If we give you a spot in this university, you're taking it away from a man who has a family to support. And you don't have to work. I mean, they just assumed women didn't have to work. And so I think with the passage of Title VII and the formation of NOW, women realized that they were being treated like second-class citizens, and it was only logical for them to join NOW, which was the first organization at that time formed to fight for women's rights.
So Do you think the founding of NOW revolutionized women's rights?
I haven't had the slightest question about it. Absolutely it did, and the effect of what has happened in this country is spilling and has spilled over to the rest of the world.
How do you think women's rights has developed since the founding of NOW?
Before I answer that, I want to say a little bit more about Title VII, but now I almost forgot, about revolutionizing this country. I want you to know that when we formed NOW, it didn't occur to us that it would have the revolutionary effect. It's been nothing short of a legal revolution in women's rights in this country because of Title VII and NOW. When we founded NOW, our goals were much more, not that extensive. We wanted women to be hired and promoted and treated equally on the job. We wanted them to be allowed into colleges and universities on an equal basis. Those were really the two main things we thought about. It didn't occur to us, certainly not to me, you know, I didn't hear from anybody else, this is my understanding. We had no idea it would have the extensive and deep effect that it had. It went way beyond anything we ever thought of. I remember something like 25 years after the passage of NOW, I once said to Betty Friedan and to others, whoever thought all this would happen? It was way beyond our wildest expectations. Now you can go to your next question.
So how do you think women's rights has developed since the founding of NOW?
Well, I give speeches, my dear, that last an hour where I talk about that. So there isn't an area of American life that hasn't been touched by the revolution in women's rights. Every area of life has been affected. Because basically, this country was run on the principle that all the important things, all the big jobs, belong to men, and that a woman's place was in the home, making a home for her husband and raising her children. And men and women lived in two different worlds. That is no longer the case.
What problems still remain in women's rights? And what advice would you give to young women today?
Well, let me take your first question. I'd really have to look, as I mentioned, I give speeches on this that run about an hour or 45 minutes, and a big section of those speeches deals with the problems that remain both in the United States and worldwide, and they are immense. What we have achieved, as I mentioned to you, was beyond our wildest expectations. On the other hand, the problems that remain are huge. We still don't have equal pay. Women, if you consider all working women versus all working men, women earn 79 cents to the dollar that men earn. Now, not all of that is the result of gender discrimination, but some of it is. Violence against women is a huge problem. Rape is a huge problem in our colleges and also from kindergarten through the 12th grade of high school. Sexual harassment, sexual assaults, big problems in the military, big problems on campuses. I'd have to look at one of my speeches, but I have about 20, and that isn't exhaustive. It goes on and on. Women aren't treated equally in the entertainment industry as producers, directors, actors. Women are subjected to horrific treatment when they're prisoners. In some states, they are, when a woman prisoner is in labor, she's shackled to the bed. And even in states where this has been outlawed, it's not necessarily followed. In the justice system, with regard to being judges and prosecuting attorneys and so on, women are not treated equally. When women professionals write scholarly papers, if they write them with men, very often the paper is attributed to the man and the woman co-author is forgotten. I could just go on. And in the rest of the world, we have female genital mutilation, we have forced marriages, we have honor killings, we have child marriages, we have people throwing acid in the face of schoolgirls. It just goes on and on. The struggle goes on, but we're not where we were.
And what advice do you have for young women to help solve that problem?
Well, it's not a problem that's going to be solved today or tomorrow. The advice, first of all, I don't particularly like giving advice to people, but since you're asking, we now have a president who is leading a war against women with the help of his Republican colleagues. This is not new, but he's reinvigorating it. They just had an anti-abortion march in Washington yesterday, and for the first time in our history, a high government official, Pence and Kellyanne Conway, both of them spoke at the anti-abortion rally. Such a thing has never happened before. First of all, I would tell women and men, boys and girls, this is not just a women's issue. Every girl and woman has an impact on men and boys in her life. This is an issue for men and women and for boys and girls. I would urge all of them to become familiar with the history of the fight for women's rights. I don't know what's happening today in schools. Of course, when I went to school, we hadn't had the second wave yet, so they couldn't have taught us that. Well, we didn't learn a hell of a lot about women's rights, which had started, the fight had started in 1848 when with the Seneca Falls Convention in New York. We didn't learn a lot about it. There's much more that could be learned today. So the first thing I would tell boys and girls, men and women, is to learn the history of the women's movement, also to learn the history of the black movement, and also to learn about Hispanics, but we're talking about women. And the second thing I would tell girls and women and boys and men, if you are interested in the rights of women, join an organization like NOW or other organizations. There are plenty of organizations. Or start one if there isn't one where you are, and work with other men and women to improve the rights of women and girls.
So, looking back, is there anything that you would have done differently?
No. I'm glad I had the privilege to be a part of that movement. I am still, every day and just about every hour, involved with feminists all over the United States and some in the rest of the world. I am in touch with feminists all the time. That is the passion of my life. I don't know what I would have done differently.
Okay, that's all the questions I had. So.
Okay. I had one question for you, if you don't mind.
Not at all.
I was just curious, how did you come to be at the EOC originally?
Well, you'd have EOC. To read my book to find that the answer to that, because it's a long story. Yeah. I'll try to make it shorter. I am Jewish, and I was born in Berlin, Germany. And my immediate family and I were fortunate enough through the insistence of my brother, who was 14 years my senior. We left Germany in 1933. We spent 9 months in Belgium, and then we were very fortunate to be able to get on a ship and come to the United States. So my life was saved. My life was also saved earlier. My mother in Germany had had 7 abortions. She was married to my father, but they were well-to-do, and my mother told me it wasn't fashionable for well-to-do people in Berlin to have a lot of children. Now, I don't understand this because all they had was my brother. But anyway, after my brother, my mother had 7 abortions. And in the last one, a year before she became pregnant with me, she'd had an ectopic pregnancy. And it took her a year to recover. and she was told that she must never get pregnant again. And then she became pregnant with me.
Huh.
And she went to her favorite abortionist. She had two. But she went to the favorite one, and he was having an affair with a ballerina and had gone away with her for the weekend. So our mother came home and went to bed, and my father came home from work, and he saw her in bed, and he said to her, "You had it done?" And she said, "No, Dr. So-and-so is out of the country. I'll go to Dr. So-and-so next week." And my father said, "Nah, let it be already." So that's why I was born. The second time my life was saved. So my life was saved on two occasions, and in addition, I was bright. So I put that together, and I said to myself, my life has been saved, so there must be something that I'm supposed to do. I can't just live like anybody else, and I can't just get married and have a family and stay home. There was something I'm supposed to do. So I went to law school, and then I went to work for the federal government, but I never stopped looking for that job that I was supposed to do and for which my life was saved. And when I came to the EOC, and if you read my book, you'll find out how I got the job there. But when I came there and I was involved with interpreting a law that prohibited discrimination, I had found that job.
Wow. That's very interesting. You're in Sarasota now, is that right?
I live in Sarasota, that is correct.
Yeah, my dad, he passed away about 20 years ago, but he had been an attorney, and then he, in his retirement years, he was down in Bradenton there.
Huh? That's the next village over.
Yeah, yeah. Very interesting stuff. So.
Well, if you find it interesting, you may enjoy reading my memoir.
Yeah, absolutely.
Get it from Amazon.com. Around here, or you could recommend to the library that they buy it, or else get it. You can get it from Amazon.com. They have it in hard copy and soft copy for Kindle.
Excellent. We will definitely do that.
Yeah. And it's written with humor, so you would enjoy it.
Excellent. Okay. Do you want to?
Okay. Thanks for taking the time to just do this interview. It was really helpful.
You're very welcome, and I'm delighted that you've chosen this topic to write about or make your project about.
Great. Okay, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Bye-bye.
Bye.